Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. The panel this morning will be myself, Judge Brigham, and Judge Gabriel. We have four cases being submitted today, three of which are being submitted with oral argument. We're going to hear our first two cases scheduled for 9 o'clock, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and hear the third case at 10:30. Would you please call the first case?
May it please the court. On July 28, 2010, the Honorable Judge John Chupp entered a summary judgment in favor of the appellee WB Discovery Resorts against the appellants Ken and Betsy Gross. Ken and Betsy Gross request that this court overturn the granting of the summary judgment for five separate and independent reasons. First, the merger doctrine does not bar the breach of contract claim, since the exception to the merger doctrine of fraud, accident, or a mistake is applicable.
And how do you address the assertion that it wasn't pled?
Your Honor, it doesn't have to be pled. They did plead negligent misrepresentation. And if you look at the underlying cases, including the Metro Media case, Your Honor, negligent misrepresentation is a specie of fraud.
Are you going to assert that in your summary judgment proof that you put on all of the elements of fraud?
We put in all the elements of negligent misrepresentation, Your Honor, and that's the standard that we have to satisfy. Moreover, Your Honor.
Well, I don't remember an exception to, to the merger and bar rule being negligent misrepresentation. I remember it being fraud.
Well, Your Honor, if you actually look at the Dallas Court of Appeals case, the ECC Parkways case, and you look at the first two paragraphs of that, Your Honor, in that case, the court specifically held that negligent misrepresentation was applicable when dealing with the merger doctrine. In that case, that's a Bickel and Brewer case, and there's a web of various causes of action that's alleged. And if you look at the first paragraph, it says that the causes of action pled were fraud, negligent, and negligent misrepresentation.
So the difference is they did plead fraud.
They did plead fraud, Your Honor, but if you look at the second paragraph, it says that the merger doctrine applies to the claims pled. The ECC Parkways court did not specify and say the merger doctrine only applies to the fraud claims. It says it applies to the fraud, to the claims pled, including DTPA. They didn't specify it. Now, opposing counsel would like to say that you have to plead fraud in the inducement in order to have the merger doctrine apply. But that's not what the case law says, and the first two paragraphs of that opinion is very much on point.
So we have to extrapolate from that this exception that has been established over the years to apply only to fraud, mistake, and accident.
I don't think you have to extrapolate. I think you have to clarify. And that opinion is directly on point. But we're not the only...
It's not directly on point because fraud was pled.
Fraud was pled. And, Your Honor, usually you do see fraud pled. Obviously, this is the exception where we have negligent misrepresentation pled and negligence and breach of contract and not fraud. But that case was very clear that fraud, that the negligent misrepresentation claim was accepted out with the merger doctrine with the exception of accident mistake.
Well, we'll ask opposing counsel in a minute why you have to plead it if you put on evidence of it. So regardless of whether you pled it or not, are you telling us that you put on evidence of each element of fraud?
We put on evidence of each element of negligent misrepresentation, but I would also say, Your Honor, that there was the evidence of fraud. If you looked at and we cited to the underlying HUD report, which clearly had misstatements in them. That counts. In addition, Your Honor, there were the more oral representations both prior to and subsequent to the execution of the contract, the first oral representations saying that there's not a water issue in regards to this lot, and the subsequent oral representations that they would fix this. We pled and we satisfied the elements of fraud.
All right. Do you have your brief with you?
I do, Your Honor.
Would you look on page 13?
Yes, sir.
Would you tell me what point you're making on the bottom half, beginning with the exceptions? I'm not picking up what you're saying there about reliance. What are you saying there?
I think what the brief was saying, and the brief was written by prior counsel, Your Honor, but what the brief is saying is that the court in the 2011 Italian Cowboy case is hiring or raising the standard if you're going to enforce a merger or integration clause. In that court, in that case that's cited in there, the Italian Cowboy case, the court said that a general merger clause was not would not satisfy and defeat a fraud in the inducement claim. Instead, it said that you had to specifically state that pre-contractual representations in the merger clause, that you were disclaiming those. And in our case, Your Honor, we have the same type of merger clause as in the Italian Cowboy case.
All right.
Your Honor, we'd also like the court to look at the totality of the circumstances test. That's set forth in the Prudential case. In the Prudential case, the court said there were four different factors that the court would consider in enforcing an as-is clause. One factor was whether it was a bargain for term. The second factor was, is there counsel represented on both sides? The third factor was whether the as-is clause was part of a negotiated settlement. And the fourth factor was, were the parties sophisticated business players? In this case,
let me ask you a question about that.
Yes, sir.
At some point, I recall in your brief, you said that you were an experienced home builder, but you weren't experienced in purchasing lots, which to me didn't make any sense. How are you an experienced home builder without lots?
Your Honor, and I think it's actually the other side that said, with all due respect, that we were an experienced home builder. What we said in our brief is that we had purchased we'd built six homes prior to this.
Okay.
But in all six occasions, our customers had actually already acquired the lot and then come to us and ask us to build the homes.
Okay.
So if you look at the first three factors, they don't even argue the first three factors. This was not a negotiated term. The as-is clause was not part of a settlement. We certainly weren't represented by counsel. They try to paint Mr. Gross as an experienced, sophisticated business player. I just pointed out he only had six homes that he had built. What their brief is silent on is Mrs. Gross. Moreover, Your Honor, the as-is clause is not applicable because if you look at the as-is clause, it specifically states that except for contractual representations, the as-is clause is applicable. Your Honor, it's our contention that the HUD report, which was attached to the contract, is part of the contract. The Owens case from the Texas Supreme Court specifically states that you can integrate as part of the contract unexecuted attachments or addendums to the contract. It's our belief that the HUD report was part of the contract. And because of that, the as-is clause is not applicable. Moreover, Your Honor, the as-is clause is not applicable because it would violate federal law. The federal law is very clear in the Full Disclosure Land Act, 15 U.S.C. 1701. Let me make sure that I cite this correctly, Your Honor. That act requires that WB provide the Grosses a HUD property report. The purpose of the act is to prevent a developer from providing any report with any untrue material fact or any omission of material fact. Now, WB's brief does not really address this section. Instead, significantly, they just ignore it and say that it's inapplicable because the Grosses didn't plead fraud or didn't seek a cause of action under this federal statute.
Don't they also say it's not applicable because it wasn't signed by everyone?
Right, Your Honor. And I'm not sure. It doesn't have to be signed. It's signed by every party if you were going to rescind the contract. If you actually look at the document itself, you only sign the HUD provision if you were going to rescind the contract. You can rescind it up until 7 days after the contract is signed, or if you don't get the HUD report, you can rescind it up to 2 years after the contract is signed. But just because the contract, just because that provision isn't signed, doesn't mean that it's not part of the contract, and that's the Owens case from 1964, Texas Supreme Court.
While there was a reference to the HUD report in the contract, it wasn't specifically integrated within the contract, was it?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
So you're saying every outside document that a contract references, it becomes a part of the contract?
I'm saying in this specific instance, Your Honor, it does become a part of the contract. And the reason why is you have to look at what the federal statute says. It says you cannot disclaim this act. If you believe their position, then every HUD report would be immaterial. Every developer would have the financial incentive and the legal shield to provide faulty HUD reports and just ignore the federal statute.
So if the federal statute doesn't apply for whatever reason, then the HUD report's not integrated within the contract?
I think it is integrated as part of the contract because it is attached or referenced in the contract. And in addition, if you look at paragraph, I believe, 17 of the contract, it references that future other documents will be exchanged among the parties. It doesn't specifically say the HUD report, but that's the type of document that that paragraph is referencing. Certainly, as part of a contractual arrangement, they turned over the HUD report. That was part of the contract. We could use the HUD report to cancel, or that addendum, to cancel the contract if we wanted to. If it wasn't integrated in the contract, then how could we cancel that contract with that same attachment?
All right. Well, returning to the Federal Disclosure Act, you didn't plead it.
Didn't have to plead it, Your Honor.
Why not?
It's not a requirement to plead it. It's just a requirement under the act that you can't disclaim it.
But and you're claiming a violation of it.
Sure. And, Your Honor, I was thinking about the – I was trying to think of the analogous situation, something that we might see in Texas. If the court goes out and buys a used car tomorrow, you are going to see an odometer report. You sign that there's 52,000 miles on that used Camry that you just purchased. Well, if that odometer report is fraudulent or contains – incorrect information, nothing bars me from suing for breach of contract, negligent misrepresentation, or fraud. But there is a state statute that says they have to turn that over. I don't have to sue under that state statute just despite the fact that they turned over a fraudulent odometer report. I have other common law causes of action that I can assert. The other point that I'd like to address, Your Honor, is the economic loss rule.
Yeah, but you're, in your odometer example, you're not using the statute. You're just saying, here's a false odometer report.
Sure.
Okay, here you're trying to use the act as opposed to use the facts that the acts prohibit. So I'm not getting, what's the point of the act?
I think the point of the act is make sure that you turn over truthful information. That the when the act was instituted by the federal government, they knew that, especially dealing with developers, that there is a disparity of bargaining positions between a developer and a purchaser of a lot. And the act is to make sure that the developer turns over truthful material information to the purchaser. In the odometer example, Your Honor, if I was a used car salesman and I didn't turn over the odometer statement, then I believe that a purchaser could, and I told the purchaser, hey, there's 70,000 miles on this, and they find out that there's really 100,000 miles on it. I think that the purchaser, as part of their fraud cause of action or negligent misrepresentation cause of action or breach of contract cause of action, could assert that I didn't comply with the statute when I was supposed to turn over the odometer statement.
I'm having trouble understanding how that's fraud, but okay, go ahead.
Your Honor, the last point that I would like to bring up is the economic loss rule. Now, opposing counsel has claimed that because negligent misrepresentation and breach of contract were both pled, that we are barred. However, negligent misrepresentation has a different set of damages than breach of contract. Negligent misrepresentation damages are limited to economic loss. A breach of contract damages are limited to foreseeable consequential damages. There is a difference there. With economic loss, you get basically the value, the damages to the lot. With foreseeable consequential damages, Mr. Gross could also receive money related to loss of business, hurting his credit reputation. Anything that's out there that is outside the scope of economic damages, he's entitled to it under the breach of contract claim. because there are two different baskets of damages, the economic loss rule does not apply. And I will point the court's attention to the Sherry Land Water Supply Corp case, 354 Southwest 3rd, 407. That's a Texas Supreme Court 2011 case, which specifically states that. Your Honor, for each of the reasons that we've set forth today, we respectfully request that the court overturn the granting of the summary judgment and rule in Mr. Gross's favor and send this case back to the trial court for a trial on its merits.
May it please the court, Brian Rutherford for the appellee, WB Texas. Addressing different points that were raised by different justices. Justice Gabriel, you asked about the future other document. What was intended with respect to the as-is clause? What was intended to be that future document? We would argue that the warranty deed, the deed that actually conveyed the thing, the piece of property, that was the eventual document, and that's the one that rolls everything up into the merger doctrine. That's the one that was the final document that transferred the land. So counsel saying that the HUD document was some future document, we would dispute that. We would argue that the actual deed that conveyed the property is the future document, the one that came together and transferred the thing. Justice McCoy, you talked about whether they need to plead an exception to merger. We argue that they do.
Why?
Because two reasons. One is a matter of pleadings. We had to have actual notice of.
Well, I know, but if they, let's just say, wasn't summary judgment, we're at trial, they don't plead fraud.
Yes, sir.
They start to put on evidence of fraud.
I would say
that's fine, but it's subject to objection. So it seems to me, even in a summary judgment setting, if they don't plead fraud, but they put on evidence through affidavits of fraud, you have a right to have that stricken because it's not pled. But if you don't, then it comes in whether they pled it or not.
So it was, I apologize.
Is your position that they did not put on evidence of fraud, or they did put on evidence of fraud but it wasn't pled?
That, both. They did not put on evidence, and in fact that's in the, excuse me, Your Honor, it's in the recorder's record. The trial court was asking repeatedly, and page 72 is one, what is the evidence? What evidence do you have of fraud? And prior counsel for the appellant said, I agree, it's not attached to my evidence today. She's saying, I didn't anticipate this issue. I didn't know that I was going to need to put on evidence.
That's one example. Record?
Yes, sir,
page 72.
And there are other examples, but that's the primary one that I had flagged.
All right. I don't think it makes any difference if they pled it, but it does make a difference if they didn't put on evidence of it.
And Your Honor, we would
what
argue.
What element do you say, or elements, do you say they did not put on evidence of?
We actually didn't brief it that way,
okay.
Judge.
All right.
I can brief it. I'm happy to brief it if the court's interested in that issue, but I did not brief it in that way because it wasn't pled. I didn't attack the lack of each element. With respect to the question about federal law and the odometer example, the Texas Finance Code sets out who is allowed to sell cars in the state of Texas. It'd be a new car dealer, used car dealer, an individual who sells more than X number of cars per year. I believe it's three, although I'm not going to misrepresent that. At that point, that person has to put on an odometer statement. There's different standards. I'd argue that example doesn't apply. The fact that they didn't plead the federal law, that is a separate cause of action. That is a cause of action they could have raised and chose not to for whatever reason.
Well, I mean, I think what he's saying is the as-is clause is applicable, and I think the buzzwords were something like to the full extent allowed by law, and he's saying it's not allowed by law if you violate this act. Hence, the as-is clause doesn't apply.
And
I don't know, again, if that needs to be pled, if he put on evidence of it.
And we've asserted that there's waiver because it wasn't pled, and we don't have specific evidence of whatever those elements would be because they weren't pled.
So you're saying, again, like fraud, there's no evidence that the act was violated.
That's correct, Judge. That's correct.
All right.
And because looking at the summary judgment hearing, and candidly, I was not there, but looking at the cold record, the reporter's record, it looked like the trial judge was struggling with what specific evidence do you have for these specific elements that you are raising now in front of me today. because there was an issue about whether that was in, whether that was something that had been pled, was properly before the court. There was some discussion of what had happened with other parties, but not as to the appellants. The appellants had not put on evidence of the specific elements of what they were pleading in front of the trial court that day. Again, I apologize for jumping around, but I'm trying to address specific questions that were asked. With respect to the merger doctrine and the lack of an exception that was pled for fraud, mistake, or accident, we would ask the court to decline to be the first in Texas to create such an exception. There are cases that are cited. I believe the Washington Supreme Court was one, and then there was another out-of-state court opinion, high court opinion, that the appellants are asking this court to adopt, and we would ask the court to stand on Texas law and hold that that is a correct application, that the trial judge correctly applied it under the facts of this case, that the lack of evidence is fatal, if not the waiver on pleadings, and we would ask the court to affirm the summary judgment. And with that, I'll tender the remainder of my time back to the court.
Not just yet.
Yes, sir.
On page 24 of your brief.
Yes, sir.
You say the presence of water on the property was expected and was common knowledge available to the Grosses. The Hood report, property report, unequivocally contemplated flooding during heavy rainfall on their lot?
On all the
on
lots.
Two lots.
I believe it was on all the lots, Judge. It was the 100-year flood event they were talking about for the entire property. That's specifically what I was referencing.
All right. All right. You've made some point about the Hood report was not signed by three people. You made that on page 15 of your brief. So
yes,
what?
Sir.
I mean, if I'm not saying it is, if it's incorporated otherwise, what difference does it make if it's not, but not all three parties signed it, as is required by the integration clause?
The integration clause of the contract? They're
yes.
saying that the HUD report became part of
the contract. I
understand. Sure.
So what? Three signatures?
If we're going to require it to be part of the contract, it has to comply with all the parts of the contract that are applicable to it. If it's an external document and we're saying that the integration clause requires all signatures, then it's got to be there.
That doesn't make any sense. What if the contract itself said and the Hood report is incorporated into this document for all purposes? Are you going to tell me that it's not incorporated because not everybody signed the Hood report, which certainly isn't required of the builder?
That isn't the situation we have here.
I understand
here,
that. But what I'm saying is you're telling me that it can't be incorporated unless it follows all of the parameters of the contract, including all three signatures, and I'm saying that doesn't make any sense.
I would argue that under the facts of this contract and the integration clause of this contract that it would follow.
Okay. All right. Okay. Now, he says, can you talk to me a minute about whether the Hood contract is excluded or included? Obviously, you specifically say, I believe on page 13 of your brief, that it is excluded. It is not included absolutely positively. Okay,
Correct.
To me about that.
And I see I did on page 15 as well. Contrary to the Gross's assertions, the special okay. warranty deed and purchase contracts specifically exclude the HUD property report.
Yes.
And I refer to the as-is clause in the special warranty deed, conspicuously stated, all capital letters. And then that's where I go into the statement about the integration clause requires all parties to sign. And because of the language of this particular document, that's why I say that it is specifically excluded.
Well, how do you handle his argument that it's referenced, therefore it's included? Why reference it if you're not including it? What's the point?
Ultimately, and this may go to Judge Gabriel's question as well, the question is, what do we do with this? Because we are contemplating we're going to sign final documents. Once everyone does their due diligence, once everyone looks at the property, which Mr. Gross testified he went out and looked at the property. He testified he had the opportunity to read the contract, chose not to as to parts of it, but had the opportunity. I dispute that he was an unsophisticated builder. I understand opposing counsel said that he had...
Are we wandering around the
question? I'm hitting 3 points and then coming back to a judge. I apologize.
Okay.
the future document, the ultimate thing was going to be the warranty deed. So we have an interim document along the way. I argue that it specifically excludes the HUD property report. But even if we look at that, what was ultimately conveyed was in the special warranty deed, and we've got an as-is clause.
Okay.
And where I was wandering a little bit, Judge, was opposing counsel made the statement that six properties had previously been worked on by Mr. Gross as a home builder. Actually, I believe the evidence showed and the argument in the reporter's record was that he had, in fact, bought at least one other property before this, that was the evidence in the record.
All right. Do you have your brief?
I do, Judge.
On page 11.
Yes, sir.
You know, we actually read this stuff. Is there... What point are you making in your heading C? And does not raise, is that point?
Gross's evidence to support the breach element is irrelevant and does not raise. Correct, Judge. That is typographical.
Okay, okay. I'm not picking on you. I'm just
trying
to keep straight. Okay. Talk to me a minute about the economic loss rule.
Yes, sir.
And why negligent misrepresentation from Sherry Land and Formosa and whatnot doesn't vitiate that or
yes, sir.
What word you want to use.
In Sherry Land, that was the Texas Supreme Court's first chance to really address in a long time. Yes, sir. Negligent misrepresentation. The argument I would make is that it includes consequential damages. You're always going to argue that, a breach of contract is always going to include consequential damages, and that's what they pled here. They pled damage to the property itself, which is the subject of contract. All the other things that they argue arise out of that and they try to fit under negligent misrepresentation, those are consequential damages flowing from the alleged breach of the contract. Because those are all still fall under the same umbrella and we have a contract between these two individuals, the difference between the analysis in Sherry Land, to the extent there is any difference, is that addressed contractual strangers and what do we do in that situation. I don't think, and I'm
not following you. I'll just tell you.
Okay.
You lost me.
Negligent misrepresentation, the damages that they are seeking for that still fall under consequential damages arising out of the breach of the contract. So the economic loss doctrine would still bar those kinds of damages, no matter how they're pled. Doesn't matter if we call it negligent misrepresentation. If they are consequential damages arising out of a breach of the contract, that's what they are as a matter of law.
All right. We'll ask opposing counsel here in a minute to address that. Okay.
So for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the summary judgment.
Your Honor, first, as to your point of addressing the Sherry Land case, the Sherry Land case is very clear that certain torts are barred under the economic loss rule, but that negligent misrepresentation is not one of them.
I think the point he was, making was that the damages in this case from your negligent misrepresentation are the same as breach of contract, hence what's the point?
Because there's two different baskets of damages that you could recover, Your Honor.
Right, so you're just disagreeing with him that the damages are consequential or the same?
Yes, sir, I am.
And what are those that are not consequential? What damages are not the same? Let's make it easier. What damages did not flow from the breach of contract, you say that do flow from negligent misrepresentation?
None, Your Honor.
Okay.
There are additional damages that you can recover because of the breach of contract claim. The breach of contract claim has expanded damages that you can recover. Under the negligent misrepresentation, it's only economic loss. But it's possible that the court could rule for economic loss damages related to negligent misrepresentation and award different damages for a breach of contract claim. It's possible.
Okay, in this case, what difference does it make? Tell me about in this case, what difference does it make if we apply the economic loss rule or not?
It makes a difference because it would give them a basis to knock out the negligent misrepresentation claim, or because it is the same as the breach of contract claim, under the economic loss. However, Your Honor, the courts have been very clear. It's not just Sherryland. There's a whole line of cases where
Wait, are you concerned that damages are being lost or your cause of action's being lost, and you're concerned about your cause of action being lost because of the as-is clause and so forth and so on?
I'm concerned about my cause of action being lost, Your Honor.
Okay, well, it seems to me that you can, that you could prevail on your cause of action, and just because your damages are limited, that doesn't knock out your cause of action.
I understand.
I mean, okay, so you're telling me that you're not concerned about extra damages you may get whether or not the economic loss rule applies. You were thinking that if you can't get the damages, your cause of action goes away.
Right, and I don't.
Okay, I don't think that's right. You get your cause of action, whether you may not get the damages may be limited by the economic loss rule.
I understand, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, I would also like to point the court's attention to the last sentence above the contract, above the signatures on the contract. And in that last sentence, Your Honor, it says, if you did not receive a property report prepared pursuant to the rules and regulation of the Office of Interstate Land Sales Registration, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, in advance of your signing of the contract or agreement of sale may be canceled at your option for 2 years from the date of this signing. And then the parties executed the contract. They're taking the position that the HUD report was not part of the contract because it wasn't specifically referenced in, but right above the signature line, it actually references the HUD report.
They didn't say it wasn't a part of the contract because it wasn't referenced. I mean, they didn't say that.
Your Honor, they're making the argument that the reference either wasn't strong enough or the integration clause knocked it out. And I don't see how you can say an integration clause can knock it out when it's specifically included in that contract, and the as-is clause says, except for contractual representations, this property is being sold as-is to the extent permitted by law. This is a contractual representation that is referenced in the contract that the as-is clause does not knock out.
Okay.
That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your well-written briefs and your oral argument this morning. Your case is submitted.
Thank you.
Yes.